Welcome to Misadventures in Music, wherever you happen to be listening. My name is Mick Ord.
My name's Ian Prowse.
And today we're going to look at a singer-songwriter who actually has had a higher profile recently than he's probably had for more than 20 or so years.
Yeah, also the subject of one of the best music documentaries you'll watch.
Yeah.
Certainly in the modern era.
It was on last year, but it's going to be on. It's on BBC iPlayer now for the rest of this year. The guy in question is Alan Hull.
Yeah.
And just to break you into his music, if you don't know it, we're going to play a track from his first band, which is Lindisfarne. And this was a massive hit for them back in the 70s.
Silken ghostly thread. I gaze with troubled vision on an awful poster bed, where Eleanor had risen to kiss the neck below my head and bid me come along with her to the land of the dancing dead. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. Loving beauty like a mother to a son, like living, dying, seeing, being all rolled into one. And all at once I heard some music playing in my bones, the same old song I'd heard for years reminding me of home. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. Me licking lips with tongues of fire, a host of golden demons screaming lust and beast desire. And when it seemed for certain that the screams could get no higher, I heard a voice above the rest screaming, "You're a liar." But it's all right, Lady Eleanor.
Lady Eleanor by Lindisfarne. I remember the first time I heard that back in 72, and it was magical. It was not like anything else on the charts that they played during the day on Radio 1.
Because it's kind of a folk song, but it's not, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I have to be honest at the very top of this to say that I know or knew next to nothing about Lindisfarne. I'd obviously heard of them and knew that they were connected with the Northeast. And I kind of thought, I won't be that interested. But how wrong I could be, because I watched the documentary and the amount of resonances I felt with the songwriting, the singing, the emotional feeling around the whole thing has kind of left me reeling. And I feel as though I now have an entire world to explore. An incredibly talented fella.
Yeah, definitely. Wonderful. I mean, this documentary that was on BBC Four a couple of months ago, and as I said at the beginning, you can catch it on iPlayer all year. It's called Lindisfarne's Geordie Genius, Alan Hull. And the guy whose brainchild it was, in fact, the producer of the documentary, Jed Clark, has joined us. Jed, welcome to Misadventures in Music.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. Well done, mate.
Yeah, well
Four
done.
4 years it took you to get that on the TV.
Yeah, it's been a long road. But, I mean, and the dilemma is, I mean, we wanted to make a film to tell people that this is an unforgotten hero and really he should be much lauded and he's not. And that was the thrust. But people are saying, don't really want to know. Do it because I don't know who he is, you know, and that's the whole point. You don't know who he is, but he's brilliant, you know. And we had to coax out all these stars who just say, well, they didn't take any coaxing actually. All these big names said, I'll talk about him, he's brilliant.
I mean, you got Sting, Elvis Costello, Dave Stewart,
Peter Gabriel,
Mark Knopfler.
How did you get them?
You just rang them up,
and really, as simple as that.
No, well. I was very fortunate in that my associate producer was Ray Laidlaw, who was the drummer, the original drummer in Lindisfarne,
right.
And the drummer in Lindisfarne forever. He's a great guy, knows everybody, knows the music business really well. We sat down and said, let's do this, we've got to do it, make it happen. That was 4 years ago. I said, what we need is a calling card, let's make a little trailer about it. Who can we get? And he said, well, I can get Sting. And I said, can you? So he just emailed Sting and he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then I said, oh, well, if we've got Sting, we can now tell people Sting's doing it, so can you join us? And we emailed Elvis Costello's people and Peter Gabriel's people, and they both came straight back and said, yeah.
Fantastic.
Because we knew, we'd read stuff about them saying, Alan Hull was great, he should be recognised, and they were singing off the same hymn sheet as we were. So,
oh, well done, because... For people that don't know, getting that kind of documentary on the TV, particularly the BBC.
Well, actually, it wasn't. We got the trailer made, but that was only half of it, because we still couldn't get a commission.
Yeah.
And even though we had those names, we thought, my God, what we got to do?
Yeah.
And then last, well, say 2020 it was, Sam Fender released Winter Song, one of Alan's great songs. And he did it as a sort of... A charity single for the homeless in the Northeast, in Newcastle, because right. That's what it's about, basically. We were thrilled, because suddenly Alan was getting mentioned, because it said, where did this song come from, Sam? And he said, oh, it's Lindisfarne, man. And then it just went from there. And we'd already approached Sam, because Ray knows him, of course, he knows everybody up there. He was going to do an interview if we got the documentary, but then we just thought, let's ask Sam to front this, and it might just open a door or two. And I think that was the clincher, really.
Oh, nice one.
Because you've suddenly got a whole new audience. He's a very happening guy. He's a brilliant talent as well.
Yeah.
And he genuinely likes his music. He likes that. He didn't know enough, but he knew he was a Geordie legend. And he as a kid, he used to go to open mic nights and play Lady Eleanor. So
wonderful. Ian is bursting to ask you loads of questions. Can I just ask you to rewind? We played Lady Eleanor at the beginning, and until I did a bit of research on this, I had no idea what that song was about, and I misheard a lot of it. Will you fill us in on that?
Well, it's a beautiful song, as they say, and it's very hard to categorise, but he mentions In Walked Roderick Usher, and anyone who's read a few books might know that Edgar Allan Poe did a short story called The Fall of the House of Usher, which is about a man called Roderick Usher. And Alan, at one period in the late 60s, worked at a psychiatric hospital in Gosforth in Newcastle, St. Nicholas's. He was just perfect for the job, apparently. He just looked after the patients really well. And he used to take them out, the ones who were allowed out during the day, and take them down the pub, which was very Alan. And, but apparently, when he was on night shift, he just read voraciously, and Edgar Allan Poe was one of his things, and he just was inspired by that story to write this sort of fantastic sort of metaphysical sort of song. But there's another thing. You see, this, as you'll know, the songs aren't just made on the spot by one thought. We were talking to Alan's best friend, Terry Morgan, who he grew up with, went to school with. And Terry said when they lived in Loaf Ell in Gateshead, there was this cut they used to take to go down to the pub. And they used to call it the Dingley Dell. And then, hey, there was an album coming in a few years down the line. But there was a statue of a beautiful woman in this Dingley Dell. And Alan used to call her his Lady Eleanor. Now, and this is obviously something in his head. Yeah. And then it just all adds up, and then, and he writes a song like that.
Yeah. The thing about the entire documentary for me is his connection with his place, his people, which I think is where Sam Fender comes in as well. And that, and you very rarely get artists who drag you into their world. They make you care about... I spent all last night thinking about my times in Newcastle in the Northeast, because... It made me care about, you know, his area. Again, Bruce Springsteen is the key guy for this. He makes me care about New Jersey. You know, it's, most of it's a dump, but his passions become my passions because he delivers it so honestly and authentically. And I just got that off the bat from watching Alan, you know, off the bat. And because a lot of my own music... you know, is steeped in this area, it felt like the same well of inspiration was coming from. And as all over, right, shot right through the documentary, is this thing, isn't there, about his connection with Newcastle and the Northeast and the coast as well. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of great shots of the coast, which obviously everybody in the area will immediately melt because it's theirs. Yeah. But it's so well done that everybody from outside of it cares as well.
It's not parochial, is it?
No, it's not
at all.
Because it's global. It's weird. It's global.
It's absolutely global. Mm. Yeah.
And it's this is what struck me about the whole thing. And then he's singing. He's always singing right up the top, and it's so true. But it's never annoying. You know, it's not like nah, it's just so tuneful. His singing is the one thing that I took away from it as a magnificent singing.
Yeah, a lot of people said nice things about his voice. I mean, Peter Gabriel was blown away by his voice and mentioned it a few times.
Yeah. It was, it's so true.
Yeah.
But it's never like, you know, demonstrative and kind of, you know, the way sometimes when people say, oh, he's a good singer, and they're really talking about glorified kind of pub singers or something because they think, you know, they can do a lot of notes or whatever. It's not like that. It was incredibly... melancholically tuneful would be the best way that I could put it. It's got yearning in it, you know, but without overplaying any sad aspects. It's just natural within the way he sings.
That's a lovely way to describe it. That is reflected in the first solo song we're going to play from Alan Hall, which is One More Bottle of Wine.
One more bottle of wine. Someone said the clock is slipping through the time. One more drink before we go. I've never met such fine and friendly folk, you know. The moment is not done, no way. There's still a lot of fun before we go. Charge it up and make it out to peace of mind. One more drink to kiss my head. Ease my aching bones and put them into bed. We don't see eye to eye. Always we can but only try in small. Of mankind, for in
we are the blind leading the blind. Let's have another drink, for God's sake. Though we're on the brink of a real bad break, let's have another drink, for God's sake. Oh, let's have another drink, for God's sake.
I absolutely love that, and I love that it's an unvarnished, tribute to the pub almost. Yeah. No, nobody writes stuff like that in that way.
No,
you know that it, because I always say this: the happiest I ever am is when I'm sat in a boozer with me mates, having a drink and talking rubbish.
Yeah,
you know, whether it be football, politics, music, and then something comes up, some laugh comes up, facilitated by the drink, and I love it, you know, and yeah. This feels like a tribute to that, but it also, there's one thing I've been dying to ask you, Jed, one thing I've been dying to ask you. What was he like?
Well, the first time I ever saw him, I was just a fan. I was still at school, Lindisfarne at Newcastle City Hall, the legendary Christmas concert, and I just thought, these were amazing, and this man, you know, when you're... If you like music, you actually read all the albums.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Actually, he's writing all the best songs here. This is the guy.
Yeah.
And so you just, your eyes were drawn to him.
Yeah.
Although Jacko was the front man in many ways because he did all the mic patter, you know, and all that. But Alan was just like the hero, along with Neil Young and Bob Dylan and people. And so I just saw him from afar. And then when I moved to Liverpool, got a job and ended up with Granada Television. And then was in that lovely position of ringing up the people and saying, oh, we could get him on the show tonight, get the band on Friday night or something, and they were in Liverpool. So things like that would happen. Then I'd meet the band afterwards and go for a drink with them, which was great. And then I sort of got to know a couple of them quite well, Ray and Alan. I remember going to a couple of Alan's solo gigs. He played New Brighton and he played West Kirby. And I took a few mates to West Kirby and he was playing the Black Horse in West Kirby. Just on his own, up in the big room upstairs. I walked in, and he's there with his roadie, just drinking his Guinness. And he said, all right, Jed, how are you doing? And I thought, it's great, he knows me.
Yeah.
And there's that light little buzz, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he just, out of the blue, said, whereabouts do you live, Jed? And I said, over the water in Liverpool. And he said, could we stop at yours tonight? And I said, whoa, you're on tour, you know.
Yeah.
He said, well, we're supposed to be staying here, but they've cocked up the rooms, haven't they, you know. Yeah. And he was obviously not very happy about this. Yeah. Well, 5 minutes later, the manageress comes over and full of apologies. Alan, it's all sorted. We've got you the best room upstairs. He says, yeah, too late. I'm stopping at me mates. And that was it. And most people would say, oh, that's handy. I've got the best room in the house. I don't have to do it. I've just got to stagger upstairs. But he said, no, point of principle. So him and his roadie followed us back home after the gig. Great gig, by the way.
Yeah.
And then he, right, drinks cabinet. He explores so
it. All of a sudden, you've got your hero in your front room.
In the front room.
How was that?
And he's got his guitar out and he sings a few songs. Oh, God, he sang a few songs for us and the beer's flowing.
Oh.
And it goes on and we're...
You must have been in seventh heaven.
I was totally, totally in heaven. But
can you remember what songs he sang? What did he sing?
Well, he asked if he had any requests, and I said, there was a song you did tonight, which I'd never heard before, and it's brilliant. It's called, the one where you mentioned the Third World War, and he says, oh, yeah, and it's a beautiful love song. And the actual line is, my heart's been through World War III.
Oh, and it's a great line.
And we actually, it's in the documentary, sort of, because he re-recorded it right at the end of his career. He did a studio version of it. And he played that for us, and we just go, this is brilliant. But the key point here is, at one point, there's nothing left to drink. And Alan sort of sees, you've got a bottle of sherry there.
Oh, Jesus.
And my mum and dad had been down for Christmas, and so there's one sherry glass full gone that my mum had had on Christmas Day or whatever. And Alan thought, I'll just pour these into a pint glass. And then he drank. He just didn't drink anything. And he just loved drinking.
Yeah.
And he just, and I said, I've got to go to work in the morning, lads. So they stayed over. I said, there's tea, there's bread and butter and bacon. Yeah. And he said, fine. We're fine. and off he went, and I think they were playing Brighton the next night. So we're driving down the south coast.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, lovely.
But what a character. And that song, One More Bottle of Wine.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, and so many of his songs mention drinking, but they're just sort of reflections of, you know, because he drank.
Yeah.
And it's a great image.
Well, you put it in the documentary whereby when he moves to, is it South Shields he moves to?
North Shields.
And the first thing that you see is the pub. Yeah. What was the pub called?
The Magnesia Bank.
Yeah, yeah.
It was his spiritual home on North Tyneside.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, and if you're working class, and this is shot right through the entire documentary, his working classness and his socialism as well. The pub really is, you know, I always go on about the Croc in town. When I first moved into the city centre 15 years ago, I needed a bass. It's the Crocodile. You know what I mean? So I put it in songs, and I meet people there, and I direct people there whenever we're doing a show, and people come in from out of town, go in the Croc. And it's kind of like pubs are these citadels of you know, good times and information, and, you know, they sometimes they maybe get a bad rep in the modern era as somehow leading to alcoholism and bad times, and we shouldn't encourage them. Nah, that's where the community is. That's where it's happening.
I think you would have got on very well with him, actually.
It's not just pubs, though, because the first song, or one of the first songs I heard was the famous song Fog on the Tyne.
Yeah.
And the opening lines to that are very kind of reflective of the working class.
Sitting in a sleazy snack bar, sucking sickly sausage rolls, slipping down slowly, slipping down sideways, think I'll sign off the door.
Just encapsulates that 70s era, doesn't it?
Well, the story is, he apparently was sat on the top deck of a bus on the High Level Bridge in Newcastle, and there was a sleazy snack bar there, and he was just looking down out the window and saw somebody just filling their face with sausage rolls, and he just scribbled it down. And he said he wrote the whole song in about 5 minutes.
Well, what's interesting about that is he's on a bus.
Yeah.
You know, he's a rock star.
Well, he wasn't then.
Oh, he wasn't then. Oh, was that earlier?
Early days, yeah.
Yeah.
But, and he said, think I'll sign off the door, because Lindisfarne had just got their first recording contract.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and he realised he's going to have to sign off the door.
Yeah.
Because the stories go that in the early days, they used to have to arrange gigs so that he could be home for signing on or get someone to sign on.
Oh, yeah, we've all been there. Yeah, I've done a lot of that.
Yeah. But no, but I mean, as a person, I mean, that probably embellished the drink story too much, but I mean, he was a lovely guy whose heart was in the right place. But you also knew who was in charge of anything in particular. If the conversation wasn't going his way, he would take over. And
Because, as I said, when I started watching it, I didn't even know he'd passed away, you know, and you see at the beginning the plaque. So I'm really open to what this story is. And as we were going along and they got really famous and the songs were big, I was kind of thinking, well, is it going to like veer off into, they're going to move to LA and drugs and heroin and whatever. But it really didn't, did it? It just kind of, it almost, the bit where Lindisfarne break up for the first time was because he wanted to write some more songs, and he was, you know, just sick of going around the same old circuit playing gigs. And so it was always about music, wasn't it, with him?
Yes.
And I love the fact that at the beginning of the documentary, it's like he's a classic 60s artist walking down that working class street in the black and white. Like, he looks like he could be a Merseybeat artist, doesn't he?
Yeah, very.
And then as it goes on, he becomes like a classic looking early 70s artist with the long hair. But then he goes on, he creates his music, and he gets better and better and better. You know, maybe not so well-known or famous, but the songwriting, it just gets better. I love that, and that definitely struck a chord with me, you know, just keeping going. And it's only about the music. Everything else is a distraction.
Yeah.
Music is the thing that counts, not the women, the money, the fame. you know, whatever, the music, and he really kept his eye on that.
And the beer.
Oh, the beer, yeah, yeah. But he kept his eye on that, didn't he, Jed?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's... I think what was interesting was, I think Rod Clements, the bassist, mentions this. He says when he did run for home because he got a bad review in London,
yeah,
he was thoroughly pissed off, and he wrote that song, Run for Home.
Yeah.
And but when he did come home and they reformed Lindisfarne, he was always looking at making little solo albums on little minor labels in the Northeast, you know, and stuff like that, and just writing stuff that he wanted to write that he didn't feel was necessarily right for the band.
Okay. Whatever, you know? Well, it's funny you should mention that song, because when the documentary opens up and there's what I've since learned is their classic Christmas nights in the City Hall. I'm playing the City Hall with Elvis in June, so I'm really looking forward to that. Right. And I'll have them on my mind as I'm playing it, you know. The way that the crowd are just going crazy, absolutely crazy. And that's hard to do, not every artist can do that. They obviously had that relationship. And the footage from Newcastle's ground as well, St. James's Park.
Yeah. That was
outrageous.
That was a Bob Dylan gig.
Oh, was it? They were on the
bill with Santana and Dylan. And but the Dylan, his people must have said, we know who to warm up.
Yeah.
And they just had the place going nuts.
Well, when it starts and you see that reaction there getting live, you know that you're onto something then. Because not all bands can do that.
Yeah, I think it's this thing about your place and your region as well. You know, you've touched on right at the start. And I remember in the early 70s it was, I was still at school, but everyone was talking about this band who were ours. They were from our city and the Christmas concerts were selling out. And there was such a buzz about them. And then when they were on the TV on Top of the Pops and stuff, and everyone's going, oh my God, did you see them on top? And there's that thing, and I'm sure it happened in the 60s here.
With
the Beatles and it happened in other cities with other bands.
Yeah.
But they were ours and they were the one. Yeah. And Sting then touches on it that Alan Hull gives the next generation of songwriters permission to write songs about the region.
Yeah.
Because he was the first one to do
from a working class aspect.
Absolutely.
And I love that as you go on, and I don't know if you did this on purpose, but it's certainly what I took away from it, was where you interview the local Labour MP. And he says that he used to have discussions, or rather debates or arguments, about socialism. And the inference that I took from it was that the MP is just a Blairite, and that Alan was taking him to task over his centrist policies, you know, which would be very topical now,
well,
of course.
Well, the thing was, of course, this was before Blair got in. I mean, he was part of the campaign just to get Labour MPs there, and that was his man, he was candidate. And so he was leafleting, he was knocking on doors for him.
Yeah.
But, boy, he would have arguments with him. Because, and as the MP said, to be fair, he was rather further left than I am.
He was of the left of the Labour Party, so he kept him in the Labour Party family, but... It was very pertinent to today with how the Labour Party is basically split in two at the moment, isn't it? So,
but side Alan would have been on.
Yeah, absolutely, and me. But then the MP does go on to say that he basically knew much more about it than him, didn't he?
He understood his people, basically. He said he understood Northeast culture better than anyone.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, the next one we're going to play is kind of indicative of what you were saying before about, what did you call it, a melancholy...
Yearning, was the word.
Melancholy yearning.
Yearning, yeah.
Yeah, well, the next one, it's one of his later ones, but it was one of the ones that really, I thought, hit me between the eyes. It's called Breakfast.
In the morning you rise, night is still in your eyes, moving warm with content, the memory of your body's scent. I watch your striptease in reverse, dip my hand in your purse, smiling softly you say that I could not get much worse. Then scream, the cats are making steam, minding you and me, need a cup of tea, intimate breakfast scene, sausage, egg and beans, Winnipeg's jam.
walking gently and low. I ask you why you must go. Having asked it, I know. Instead of yes, you'll answer no. Oh, now, got to go back home. My time is all alone. Don't ring me on the phone. My husband will be there. It really isn't fair. He still believes in tests. Got to catch my bus. Looking through the window pane. What you're leaving me again? Wondering what's in her head. I slowly sink back to bed. And I feel so empty that I must be.
Through the window pane, watch her leaving me again. Wondering what's in her head, I slowly sink back to bed and feel so empty that I must be dead. That kind of defines melancholy, I think, doesn't it, Jed? And that was from his first solo album, wasn't it? Not one of his later ones.
No, as Ray said in the documentary, he used it to sort of pull together a lot of songs that he'd had for years, some of his earliest stuff, songs that he'd written while he was in the band but weren't band songs, and then just a couple of new songs or whatever, and it's a right hodgepodge, but they're all fantastic. It's a great album, Pipe Dreamer. It's just fabulous. But you talk about that, I mean, it's real working class stuff. It's an affair with a woman who should be at home with her kids, but the fact that she says, I've got to catch my bus. Yeah. And it's not like sort of furtively driving along in the four-wheel drive and hiding in the next street.
Well, then he throws in these kind of things like, my husband who still believes in trust. Yeah. So you've got that kind of massive guilt on her side. Mm.
It's very human, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's, you know, it rings true, doesn't it?
And it's all built around, he wants to have this breakfast with her. Sausage, egg and beans. You know?
it doesn't get better than that, does it?
Again, yeah, so proletarian, isn't it? You know, and who are we to judge, I think, is the spirit of the song.
Yeah.
You know, he's not judging anybody, is he?
No.
He's just going, this is what human beings do.
Yeah.
For all their frailties and their glory, this is...
Yeah.
And that's why it's so
special.
Well,
it's almost like the character he plays in the TV play.
Ah, yeah.
Where, for those who don't know or haven't seen the programme, he bizarrely was invited to star in one of those BBC Play for Today type things. But the writer and the guy who is in the doc is a well-known Geordie poet called Tom Pickard, and he knew Lindisfarne and he knew Alan, and he just had a feeling Alan would be perfect for this role, which is some guy on the dole who's a dreamer who thinks he should be part of the landed gentry, and it's called Squire, and it just, there's all these dream sequences where he's wearing all the gear and he's a country squire, but most of the time he's in a flat lying in his bed.
Yeah. Well, which what you say in the documentary, it's about class, isn't it?
Completely.
Which is, you know, in this country, we go to the cross on class. you know, in America they go to the cross on race, we go to the cross on class. So it's an eternal fascination, yeah. You know, and it's arguably what keeps the country back.
But what is the guy who wrote it, Tom, said, was he was perfect in the role. And he was really both pleased with his performance.
Double-edged sword.
He said he had a sulky insolence, which is like, was perfect for the role, yeah. You know? And he is like that, I suppose.
It's funny because if you are a songwriter in a band and the main fountain of the songs, you do need that kind of, as you were saying before, that drive. You know who's in command. You know they might be the nicest person on earth, but there's certain steel behind it. That's kind of what you need. Otherwise, it just doesn't, things don't get done.
Yeah.
You know?
What you were saying earlier, you maybe this was before we started, but you likened him to Ray Davies a bit. And Ray Davies starred in a play, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Songwriter or Pop Star or something. And this was early 70s. And there's a lot about Alan, I think, that is similar to Davies in that. Picking up the detail, like the sausage beans breakfast or one more bottle of wine, and then expanding it to the human condition without it sounding too...
Elvis Costello compares him to Ray Davies and says he's up there with Ray Davies at the start, you know.
Yeah. You can tell during the documentary... you know, Elvis is a genuine authority on what Alan and what he's talking about, and you can tell that he really loves it as well.
Next one we're going to play is Statues and Liberties.
Yeah, it's his final album, which was recorded the week that he died. It was amazing because he'd written all this new stuff. They went into the studio, they recorded two songs a day, Monday to Friday, and he died on the Friday night, Saturday morning.
Wow. This is in
95.
And when did the album come out?
Well, they obviously had his. They were his first passes as vocal performances, and they're all excellent.
Oh, really?
It's terrific. Yeah. And then they've done a bit of mixing and rearranged it, and it came out the following year, I think. And again on a small label.
Yeah.
And it sort of goes under the radar because of that. And because he's dead, he's obviously not going to be able to promote it or anything, but... We played it to Sam Fender the night before he started filming with us. And he came in the next day and he says, "I'm sorry, I've got a bad head." He says, "I had to open a bottle of wine to listen to Statues and Liberties." And he says, "I just kept playing it and had to open another bottle of wine." But one more bottle of wine. Yeah. But he was blown away by it because the song Statues and Liberties is basically Alan's political agenda in 1995, how he feels about the world.
Oh,
and boy, it punches you in the face.
Really?
There's absolutely no prisoners.
It's great, though, that even though it's a tragedy that he passed away way too young, it's great that he got that album done.
Yes.
You know, that's a legacy. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and Rod Clements said on our programme that he said it was such a good album and it was another leap up for him. He says, I think he'd decided he was finished with Lindisfarne then.
Okay.
It was time to just be himself and go and do it. And unfortunately, we never got to see what would have come of it. But it's a very powerful song.
And they got you on street, get some wise. Don't believe their stupid bigotry, don't believe their lies. Put on your uniform, you gotta fight to be free. While majors and generals talk about statues and liberties, and they got you on the wrong. Raise a glass to the whore. Put on your uniform, your top hat and tails. My motto is to serve you all. I am the Prince of Wales.
Look out! I'm the Prince.
So there he is, the Prince of Wales, W-A-I-L-S.
That's right down my street.
Yeah, now. Well, I mean, it, all the way from the first line right through to the end, it's like taking a big shot at
well, I just
society, I suppose.
If he was still with us, what would he make of Jacob Rees-Mogg? Because he's front and centre in that song, isn't he?
Yeah. What would he make of any of it? You know, absolutely. But it is, it's incredible. You know, there's a guy, he's 50 years old. He's not had a hit for years. But he's still, as you say,
writes songs. Yeah, yeah.
And he's still got the fire, hasn't he?
Yeah. And I love that even the People's Party stares down through the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's a call to arms. It's get on your uniform. We got to fight to be free.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really powerful.
A little bit of seeing into the future for what comes next.
Mm.
You know, with Iraq and God knows what.
But all the best songwriters do that, don't
they?
They suddenly write something in which becomes very prescient 5-10 years later or whatever.
Yeah. So it's great that he did get that album done, you know, but a tragedy at the same time.
Yeah. What was the reception like at the time to the album, Jed? I mean, was it given any reviews? Did the thing is,
because it didn't come out till, I think the big news was his death, obviously, in 95, and then... You just assume, that's it, he's gone, he's finished. Yeah. And I don't think we really knew that he'd done this. Yeah. And then eventually the guys who, like his son-in-law, Dave Huldenham, who was on the album, was one of the producers on it, they all worked very hard, got the album out. And it's, again, because he was gone and there was no fanfare. And I only sort of heard about it on the grapevine, got a hold of it and thought, oh my God, it's great. And there's the song he sang in my living room. It's been recorded.
Yeah. Roger Sherry. It's mad because in the modern era, somebody would immediately put on social media, oh, by the way, it's awful that so-and-so's died, but there's an album in the can.
Yeah.
And everybody would go, okay, well, we'll get to hear that at some point. But back then, it didn't work like that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden...
Oh, we probably would have crowdfunded it to make sure that it got finished.
Of course.
Because, I mean, look what happened to Nick Drake more than 10 years ago. He was suddenly rediscovered, wasn't he? You know?
Death is good for the music industry.
Good career move, this
is. It is a good career move, indeed.
Interesting with Alan, like, he had that towards the end of his life, a cracking album, and yet... You've got to kind of think, Fog on the Time was number one in this country for a month or so, wasn't it? The album back in the...
And it was 70s. In the charts for a year, wow. 72.
Yeah, massive, massive, massive album.
Huge.
And you forget that in that time, a band like them could come on, blitz everybody, and then have a decent career, maybe, you know. And then someone else would come along. Well, that really was big at that time. Yeah. I remember it at school. Loads of people had it. Mates going to see them, and people in Liverpool singing Fog on the Tyne. You know, get your head around that one. But it worked. It worked wherever it went.
The album, I mean, Ray Laidlaw explained it well. It was that the first album was excellent, and but it was so varied, and you couldn't really pin them down. You didn't know what they were. There were lots of things. They were playing all sorts of stuff. And then they brought in Bob Dylan's producer, Bob Johnson, who produced Blonde on Blonde. And they flew him over and said, we've got this band, we want you to produce. And he made them play everything they had for a day.
Yeah.
And then he's sort of like, yes, no, yes, no. And he stripped it down and played it. And so the whole album had a feel and a real feel. And as Ray called it, the essence of Lindisfarne came out on that album. Meet Me on the Corner was a hit. And the great irony was, Alan hadn't written it. And Rod had written it. But it was a hit. And as apparently Alan was, you know, sensible enough to say, well, it's a hit.
Yes. And then, because Joe Public doesn't care.
No, Joe Public doesn't care.
It's only us who are obsessed with music, you know.
Well, no, I just think of the man who wrote all the songs, is suddenly someone else has had their hit. But it's...
it's like Ringo... It's like Ringo writing the Beatles.
Well, Rod's not a bad songwriter, actually. And I think he got awards galore for Meet Me on the Corner, which is a great song.
Yeah,
right?
It is.
But then they re-released Lady Eleanor, which went to number three.
Right.
And suddenly Alan Hull's got a number three song. And then, you know, off they went, and they were just doing all sorts of
stuff. Did they make a few bob out of it then?
I think they obviously did quite well around Fog on the Tyne, because, I mean, you're in the album charts all year. But then it sort of, you know, ironically, their stable mates were Genesis.
Right.
And they toured together.
Yeah.
Bizarrely.
Weird.
With Van de Graaff Generator. Three of them all on stage. You know. And apparently they'd all come on stage at the end and do an old sort of folk song.
Okay. Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
sharing verses with Phil Collins and Peter Gabriel. You know. But anyway, and the story goes that Lindisfarne were managed by the label. Big mistake. Genesis had their own manager.
Okay.
So when Genesis said, we've toured too much, we need a break, they actually took a year out because their manager insisted and the label couldn't really do anything about it. And I do remember Phil Collins formed a group called Brand X for a year, and that was his breakaway, what he did in his year off sort of thing. Lindisfarne were told, right, you're going back to Japan and Australia. And that's when Alan cracks and says, I can't do this. Yeah. I need to write some songs. So they say, where's your next album? I haven't got any songs.
Walled out.
If they'd had a manager who might have said, year off, it could have been Lindisfarne, not Genesis.
If the label managed you, you've got nobody looking after your interests.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
And if they could have gone to America then and broken it, if they'd had a rest and come back with another mega album.
Yeah.
And that's what Genesis did. Yeah. And Genesis, you know, the rest is history for them.
Do you think they would have made America?
I think it depends what happened with the next album and whether there's how they wanted to play it. The problem with Alan, I think, and we touch on this, is he was a home bird and he loved being at home. Yeah. And he didn't really want to be anywhere else.
Right, okay.
Which is fair enough, you know. Yeah. But and there are certain things, you've got to play the game, I think, to be a big success.
Absolutely.
Especially in America.
Yeah. And although, I mean, they went down quite well, for according to the lads, you know, when they played there.
Well, they'd be so different to anything that the mainstream rock audience would have been used to, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
They're very like the band, and of course the band were big, but they were big because they were Dylan's band, and they weren't number one singles of a band, were they? But the Lindisfarne did a week at the Troubadour.
Wow, okay.
You know, which is all right.
Yeah.
And apparently they had to check, they signed an option to, they'd pay for the food, and it was all you can drink for free. And on the second night, they said, we're withdrawing that now.
Brilliant.
Because the Geordies were in town.
Exactly. Proper drinkers.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, in an audience of Van de Graaff Generator, Genesis and Lindisfarne, how many caftans would have been in there?
Oh, my word, the smell of musk.
At that time, you know, it would have been...
Patchouli.
Patchouli oil, Jesus.
Well, look, for a start, thanks for coming in. This has been really, really... excellent Jed, and we both loved the doco, didn't we?
This has been one of my favourite ones that we've done doing this podcast.
And so a big thank you to that. And we're going to end with one of the songs, one of your favourite songs from Fog on the Tyne, aren't we?
Well, Fog on the Tyne, great album, and everyone talks about Fog on the Tyne, Meet Me on the Corner. But he wrote a song called January Song when he was at St. Nicholas's at the psychiatric hospital, and obviously saved it for that album. And it's about mental illness. Now, I mean, how often do we talk about that now? Yeah. And how often did you talk about it in 1970 or 71?
With sensitivity and...
And incredibly sensitive man, and because he dealt with these patients, and the lyrics are so profound and powerful, and it's a great tune. And ironically as well, it's a tune that he'd had, and in the doc, we play it in the background, he's talking about him as a folk singer, and it's he's singing about his family running around the house, and Pat is in the hall and whatever, and there's all this, and you hear it, and it's called Tomorrow If I'm Hungry.
It's amazing because he's writing about mental illness, and he wrote about the travelling people. Yeah. And there's only Christy Moore I've ever known has written about travelling people. Yeah. So these are special artists that they've thinking about people, marginalised communities, where nobody else cares.
Yeah, and he wrote about songs about the environment in the early 70s, it's all stuff that's happening now. But, I mean, he was across all that. It's brilliant. And
fair play.
As you say, great songwriters are way ahead of their time.
Fair play.
I'm feeling rather sorry for a man I know. The world he holds in trembling hands is asking where to go. And as he stares out at me from the mirrored wall, I see that he is trying to cry, but the tears, they will not fall. His life is passing by behind his tired eyes, like the colours in the January sky. Useless it is to question things concerning the past. Seems so very obvious that nothing at all can last. And just as sure as tomorrow will soon be yesterday, the love you thought you occupied surely drift away. I need you to help me carry on. You need me, need you, need him, need everyone. And love is such a small word for something that is so vast, but in it lies the future, the present and the past. And speaking now of changes, I sometimes feel the fear that the reason for the meaning will even disappear. You need him, need everyone. You need
January song from Fog on the Tyne, written by Alan Hull, who we've been looking at today. That was a real misadventure, that one, I think. It was really, really interesting, wasn't it? Ian?
Absolutely brilliant. I loved the refrain on that final song there.
Yeah, just beautiful, beautiful. Way, way before his time. Let's hope more people can discover him.
Yeah, yeah, get turned on by it.
The next podcast, we'll be previewing your new album, One Hand on the Starry Plough. Looking forward to that.
And it's many meanings.
Yes. Multi meanings, that's for sure. So thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. If you've got any ideas, do bung them to us, because we're always ready to listen to them. And we'll see you in a month's time, or maybe a bit less than a month's time. We'll be looking at Ian's new album and discussing Ian's new album, One Hand on the Starry Plough, which is out in February.
Yep. See you later.